need it.
The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in the consolidated causes of State and City versus Schmidt and Austin.
May it please the court, Mr. Johnson will present arguments for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
If it pleases the court, I am Jim Johnson, Assistant City Attorney for the City of Austin, here representing the State of Texas and City of Austin in these cases. For a brief representation of fact, let me go to the board here and mention this is out of an exhibit that was in the Schmidt case. And it is, I use it here because it shows both the Schmidt and the Austex track. The Schmidt track is 75 feet by about 200 feet deep, and it's a commercial retail space that was cut out of a larger shopping center area. The Austex track is a portion of the larger shopping center area, which is also indicated by the dark line on the exhibit. The condemnation is for the U.S. Highway 183 expansion project that the Highway Department is undertaking. The taking here is a strip of grass approximately 6.5 feet wide that goes along the fronts of both of these parcels. In the before, U.S. Highway 183 is a divided highway of 6 lanes, 3 northbound, and it's in the north is to my right here, and southbound 3 lanes with grass median in between. In the remainder, the frontage roads will be moved slightly outward, but will still be at grade level. Again, 3 lanes to the north, 3 lanes to the south. The differences will be in the area that is already Highway Department property, which is the building of 6 main lanes that will be elevated approximately 38 feet high as they pass in front of this property. And of course, as a freeway, those main elevated main lanes will have on and off ramps at various places along the highway project. In the before in this property, there are reciprocal access agreements that remain in place after between the various property owners shown on the chart. So there are multiple driveways that are available to both the Schmidt track and the Austex track. In the remainder, all of the driveways remain. All remain in the same location. There is not a parking space touched. There is not a building relocated or a building site removed. There is no change in the functioning of the properties. There is no change in the use of the properties. They are commercial retail before and commercial retail in the remainder. In the trials of these two cases, there was really very little argument or discussion at all. In fact, one of the cases, it was even stipulated the value of the part taken. We are here on the damage to the remainder issue. And the crux of the issue is whether condemnation damaging will continue to be limited to effects on the property, to effects to the remainder caused by the taking of the part taken, or the uses to which the part taken may or well will or may be put, or whether the damages will be expanded to include all consequential damages and removing from the law the concept of consequential or community damages, so that anything that has affected the value of this property will be considered and included in condemnation. Article 1, Section 17 of the Constitution specifically provides, of course, the condemnation provision that no person's property shall be taken, damaged, or destroyed for a public purpose without adequate compensation. Now, the courts have for over 100 years, the earliest case I can find is 1889, the most recent 1988, have held that that is property taken, damaged, or destroyed. It is not any effect that is to be included. The Court of Appeals in these cases goes awry by abandoning that and saying, no, anything that affects the property's value is to be considered and compensated for. That sets aside a string of Supreme Court cases, beginning in 1889 with Trinity versus South Railway Company versus Meadows, that makes the point expressly that the condemnor the condemning authority is to be treated the same as a private property owner, and the damaging that's to be compensated for is a damaging that would be in existence at common law against a private party. Now, these cases are fairly unusual and were brought forward and requested to be heard because in these cases are pure, non-compensable, consequential damage cases. There are several cases in this project where there is substantial damage to a remainder. The Bundy Enterprises case is one that was one that has, I believe, been distributed to you through a supplemental filing. There was substantial damage to the remainder caused by the loss of parking area, the removal of a couple of buildings that had to be moved back. That case is mixed with the consequential damages that we are complaining of. These two cases are pure in that respect. The only testimony on damaging that the landowners put on in these two cases was what we call consequential damages, things that have no relation to a person's property taken, damaged, or destroyed. It is purely the most convenient accessibility, well, to get to this property. If you're on the main lane, you'll have to get off at an off-ramp this side of Lamar and travel a couple of blocks to get here. Or loss of visual prominence, if you could see from across the way or down the road a certain distance from another parcel, and the building of this structure will now create a barrier to that viewage that will have an effect on the property. Or construction inconvenience, not something peculiar to this property but in common with others in the project, and diversion of traffic, that they had a particular volume of traffic passing in the three lanes immediately in front of their property before, and now because the highway department has built a new road, some of that traffic may go somewhere else. Those are all areas in which Schmidt, in fact, in the trial admitted they had no property right. And that is the crux of what this is about.
Why shouldn't all these various factors that are evidentiary of the ultimate issue, diminution in property value, be admissible?
Because the Supreme Court has said, and I believe correctly so, that it must be limited to a reduction in property value the same as to a private party. What we want is the goal that's stated here.
To put the government on the same plane as the liability for such damages as a private person. And that's what we're asking for. What we want is if Target were to build a photomat facility out on the front of their property, on their own property, neighboring property owners that don't have a agreed to for compensation viewage easement transferred to them have no right of visual prominence. And if Target on their own property wishes to build a structure that might block a visual prominence to the Schmidt or Austex tracks, Schmidt and Austex have no claim against the Target building because Target is using their own property to build a structure. What we're asking for is that the highway department be treated the same as Target as their neighbor to the north. We are their neighbor to the west, and we are building a facility on our own property. This court in 1913 in Fort Worth Improvement District versus Fort Worth specifically talks about damage is a character for which, in cases of private property, compensation would have been made. That view was expressed again by this court in 1930 with Southwest Public Service Company versus Moore. Damage in condemnation must equal those damages as it would be liable for at common law if the condemning authority had not been created with the special privilege of eminent domain. You treat the two the same. The Supreme Court in 1960 in State versus Clark said that the state would be no more liable for the new construction upon its right-of-way than a private individual would be for building on its own property. And that's exactly our point. Abilene versus Downs in 1963 reaffirmed that. In State versus Walker, a direct condemnation case in 1969, the court reversed
found for the state and said, no, you limit on the retrial to property rights. In 1978, State versus Baker, the Supreme Court again said that the landowners were not allowed to recover for damages for loss of access to an irrigation well on a neighboring property when they didn't show that they had any property right to that well in the first place. 1980, the Supreme Court in Steele versus Houston, or City of Houston, favorably cites the Downs case that in order for a damage to be found, you need to show a nuisance, which is, of course, a legal cause of action. And that's our point. The damages need to be limited to a cause of action. This court has continued that process in the Wood Oil Distributing case in 1988, saying that it needs to be limited to the question whether there has been a material and substantial denial of access. That's a legal right. Legal access, the ability to get on and off the property, has been recognized and is a legal right. And if that has been denied, then the court said the trial court, prior to trial in a hearing, should determine that. And if it's been denied, then should let it in. If, on the other hand, the court says it's mere circuity of travel, it should not be allowed. It should not be in the testimony. What the Austin Court of Appeals has done in the last year is to say that's a senseless process. Everything that's going to affect this property is going to be allowed, because that's the rule that they perceive. That has never been the rule of law in Texas.
If instead of a photo map, Target decided to erect the same distance from the property line as you're building this highway, a 38-foot high parking garage with cars going in and out of it, would there be any remedy, and to cover their entire property with that, would there be any remedy at all available for these landowners?
No,
under the laws of Texas or the ordinances of the City of Austin?
Well, now, the ordinance of the City of Austin would have some restrictions on how property can be used. I mean, that's true of all ordinances.
None of those restrictions apply to the government.
The restrictions of the City of Austin would not overrule the authority of the state of Texas.
Does that make a difference, the fact that if Target were going to do this, when you say the goal is to place the government on the same plane as private persons, that there's a scheme of governmental regulation available concerning private entities like Target that does not apply to the action that the government would be taking in erecting this 38-foot high roadway next to the property?
Yeah, there is no legal recovery that a landowner would have for a neighbor building a structure on a neighbor's own property that restricts their visual prominence. The same as Schmidt and Austex have no recovery if Target decides that they really like what the highway's doing out at Balcones Woods, and they'll decide they're going to move out to Balcones Woods. What that does is change the flow of traffic. There is a diversion of business traffic that used to come through that Target parking lot that's not going to be there anymore. Now, will that affect the Schmidt tract? Yes, it probably will. That there is a volume of traffic there that won't be coming because the Target store has decided to move down the road. But Schmidt and Austex have no legal cause of action against Target for having taken away some of that business traffic. The same applies to visual prominence as applies to diversion of traffic. And there is no cause of action that an adjoining landowner has simply because someone uses their own property in a legal manner that they were entitled to use it. The opposing side cites or tries to eliminate, and the Court of Appeals has just set aside about 8 Supreme Court cases in our favor, saying, oh, well, that's inverse condemnation. There isn't anything in the law to indicate that inverse condemnation is not condemnation. Now, there are procedural differences, to be sure. There is a procedural difference probably at every step of the way. And there is also a difference on personal property, and the personal property that is destroyed for a public purpose can be part of a condemnation, an inverse case, where it's not normally part of a direct case because it's not peculiarly needed. But as to the compensation for real property, there is no difference. In fact, the very definition of inverse condemnation is that it is the avenue of relief for a property owner whose property has been taken, damaged, or destroyed for a public use without the institution of proper condemnation proceedings.
What are you quoting from?
Pardon?
What were you quoting from?
I don't have an exact quote, but there are several. There are several. That's a common definition that's used over and over and over in the cases. The very concept is it's a manner for which the landowner comes to court to claim what he was entitled to under condemnation, but didn't get because the process wasn't followed. In as early as 1885, in the Fuller case cited in the brief, the court has said, and they were talking about a jury instruction in a condemnation case, that the jury instruction limiting recovery was appropriate for the same reasons which make it proper to exclude certain factors in estimating damage under a statutory proceeding to condemn. They're saying, and have said for over 100 years, that inverse and statutory have the same measures of damages. There are lots of, almost any Supreme Court case you pick up on a condemnation case, you will find a statement made and then three or four citations. And some of them will be inverse condemnation, and some of them will be direct condemnation. They have been intertwined for decades. But the Court of Appeals says that there's some 8 Supreme Court cases that they will simply sidestep because they are inverse cases. There is no other state that I can find, and New York, in addition to Texas, Florida, California, Washington, and other states, have written specifically on that and say inverse condemnation and direct condemnation are the same when it comes to damages. The U.S. Supreme Court and U.S. versus Clark says that inverse is simply the inverse or reverse of condemnation. It's the same thing. So it's not appropriate to say that those do not apply. There are some direct condemnation cases, all of which respondents attempt to sidestep by saying, well, what was being asked for was something other than damage to property values. I think a more close reading of the case will indicate otherwise. Penny Savers in 1960 was a Court of Appeals case, but that was writ refused, and that opinion was adopted by this court. And they say no property owner has a vested interest in the traffic that passes in front of his property. That traffic volume was not to be compensated for. And that's a direct condemnation case. It's not about lost business profits. It's about vested interests in traffic. Pearland versus Alexander is a direct condemnation case that talks about the reasonably probable uses of the part taken. The part taken and the uses to which it will be put are appropriate considerations. But when you get off of the part taken and go to other elements that nobody owns, that's the essence of community damages. Community isn't just a physical area. It would be arbitrary to try to define it. A community damage is the nature of the damages. It's damages to incidental benefits that nobody owns. If you give a deed as a willing buyer and a willing seller, you deed the property rights. The willing buyer doesn't receive in the deed a guarantee to a particular volume of traffic. And if Target moves and goes out and that volume of traffic in the shopping center goes down, the buyer doesn't get to go back against the seller for a volume of traffic loss in his bundle of rights because it's not in the bundle of rights. The same thing applies to loss of visual prominence. If there's a viewage easement that's taken, damaged, or destroyed, you're compensated for that. But if it's just a visual prominence that the neighbor hasn't built a building on their lot yet, that's not in the deed that the neighbor won't build on their own lot. There's nothing in the deed that says you have a right to no construction on other people's property, whether it's private property or public property. Now, if the construction rises to the level of a nuisance, then there's a damaging against the private owner, and there would be against the state as well. It's a cause of action, and that needs to be the limitation.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Adler and Mr. McClish will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Prior to the taking in this case, and in an eminent domain case, you basically have a two-step process, even if you don't have two different special issues. You compare the value of the property immediately prior to the taking to the value of the property after the taking. Prior to the taking in the case, this property, the Schmitz property, was one of the best retail tracts in all of Austin. It was smack dab in the middle of Highway 183. There were 70,000 cars that went by. It had great visibility, great access. And for those reasons, it was able to attract national credit tenants and was a very valuable piece of property. After this project was put in place, and I point out to the court that the evidence shows that this road widening project could not have taken place but for the acquisition of the condemnee's property in this case. That after this condemnation, we now have a 40-foot-high elevated structure nearly adjacent to the property. There is absolutely no visibility. All the witnesses that testified, the real estate people, the land use people, all testified that those factors which gave this property value prior to the taking and were considered by the appraisers for the state as well as for the property owner prior to the taking, those factors were non-existent after the taking.
But I take it you concede that if no part of the Schmidt track were required for this project, there would be no cause of action for damages, even though the same loss of value in juxtaposition to the highway would be sustained.
I agree with that. And the reason for that is that's because that's exactly the way the marketplace works. And the marketplace is the great equalizer between the state and the property owner. To the degree that Target wants to do something on its property and it doesn't violate city nuisance or other city ordinances or a nuisance, there's nothing that I can do about that. But to the degree that they come to me and say, we need a square foot of your property in order to hang a guy wire down, for example, in order to be able to do their project, when they come to me in the private marketplace and they ask to buy that square foot, I'm going to charge them not only for that square foot, but I'm going to charge them for the damage that they do to my property. Private market works the exact same way. To the degree that the state is able to do its police power acts in its pre-existing right-of-way, and it doesn't need any property from me, then the just like in the marketplace, I have no recovery. Milam County versus Acres, an opinion that was adopted by the Supreme Court, it came out of the Court of Appeals in Austin, also addressed this and explained this by saying that theoretically, at the time that the original right-of-way was acquired for Highway 183, the state at that time took the right to do what it was doing at that point, plus all its future police power activities within its right-of-way. And to the degree that it does a police power act within its right-of-way today, that property owner who doesn't have any land being taken is not being paid. He was already paid for those things. But to the degree that they need new property in order to do new additional burdens, then there has been no prior compensation under the law. That is exactly what distinguishes an inverse condemnation case from a statutory eminent domain case.
So if there were property next to the Schmidt track, for example, that the state did not need any portion of, even though they suffered the same consequences, they would be entitled to nothing. But the Schmidt property would be entitled to the very same damages in this case, apart from the value of the piece itself, if the state took as little as a foot.
And the reason for that is because that's exactly the way the marketplace works.
And if the Schmidt track were bigger,
yes,
the damages would be greater.
I don't know that. That's fact-driven. And it might be if the track was bigger and had a different highest and best use, then the damages might be a lot less.
But because taking two tracks that were relatively close to one another, say adjacent, if you're taking a foot off one track and it's 10 acres, and you're taking a foot off another track and it's only 5 acres, then presumably the 10-acre track would have twice the damage.
Not necessarily, sir. This particular tract is a very small tract, and it's so small that when you get 40 feet in the air from the main lane, which is where most of the traffic is, you can't even see this track or any sign on that track or any building on that track. If that track were bigger, then those kinds of damages might not present itself. So I think that's a fact-driven issue. The distinction between an inverse case and a statutory eminent domain case is that in an inverse case, in order to get recovery, the property owner has no property taken. Before he is entitled to damages, he must prove liability. Not every damaging gives rise to a cause of action. You have to prove liability first. The cases, as opposed to a statutory eminent domain case, where liability is statutorily admitted, and the only question for the jury is what is the damage that arises from the taking itself. You go back to the cases that Mr. Johnson orally mentioned today appear in none of the briefs, the case back in 1889, the Trinity versus Meadows case. All of those cases are inverse condemnation cases, and they stand for the proposition that where the state does not take anyone's property, in order to even be able to consider the damage issues, you have to first prove liability. And we're not going to let you get to the damage stage of the proceeding until you've been able to establish a substantial material, what's later turned into being a substantial material impairment of access, some other denial of a legal duty.
Which you agree the evidence in this case does not show, if this were an inverse condemnation case.
I don't know whether it would or not. I think that in this case, I believe the impact on access was, in fact, substantial and material, given the fact situation on these properties. But I don't think that's where that issue of whether it's substantial or material is a question of liability, whether there's liability for damages. We believe and agree with the city that the measure of damages is exactly the same in an inverse case and in the statutory eminent domain case. It's exactly the same. The question is one of entitlement to get to that stage of the proceedings. The divergence between the inverse condemnation law, which was built around the principle that you have to show liability first, occurred initially with the cases that are cited in the briefs of Humphreys and Pigeonhole. Those cases then turned into or were then cited by the Penny Savers decision. And I would refer the justices to the amicus brief submitted by Judge Rayburn. Judge Rayburn is probably the preeminent eminent domain scholar in Texas. I think he's been cited 100 times by various courts in Texas on eminent domain. And he explains, I think, very well the fact that the two bases for the Penny Savers decision, the Humphreys case and the Pigeonhole case, specifically point out that their rulings in those inverse cases relate to the accrual of liability in an inverse case and not the measure of damage in a statutory eminent domain case. Then we have the Penny Savers case, which if you read it is not a true eminent domain, statutory eminent domain case at all. There was a piece of property, there was an existing road. The property owner also owned some land on the other side of the road. That was the land that was taken. He was claiming damages to a gas station that was on this side of the road. There was no unity of use. And he actually wasn't asking for remainder property damage. He was claiming a loss of access, a right of access loss, and tried to get damages. That is an inverse claim. It's an inverse claim being made in a statutory eminent domain case. That's a pendant claim. And there are a lot of examples of that. A good example would be business losses, for example. You are entitled to show in a statutory eminent domain case business losses insofar as decreases in rent or whatever are probative of property value. You are not, however, allowed to put in evidence of business losses to try and get an independent recovery for those business losses. However, if you want to go ahead and claim an independent recovery for business losses, or for goodwill in the Casaraghi case, then you have to allege a pendant inverse condemnation claim. And with respect to those issues, you then have to prove the liability necessary. A good example of that is the Sungrove case, cited in the briefs. Apartment building, got property value for the part taken, damaged the remainder, and sought lost profits. Wood Oil is a case, most recently written by this court, that specifically says the circuity of travel does not give rise, mere circuity does not give rise to liability for recovery of business loss or for personal inconvenience. Those are pendant inverse condemnation claims. All of the cases that are cited by the state, standing for the proposition that circuity of travel is not compensable, are cases that are either inverse condemnation cases, which aren't discussing the measure of damages at all, they're discussing the accrual of liability, or condemnation cases, statutory cases, which had a pendant inverse claim, and the court was writing on the accrual of liability on that pendant inverse claim.
Why shouldn't the landowner, however, if for no other reason than enhanced congruence of the law, be relegated to damages for inverse condemnation rather than direct condemnation, whether any part of his property is being taken or not? Why should he be different from his neighbor whose property is not taken? Why aren't they both left to an inverse condemnation action?
Because the marketplace would treat each of those people differently. The market, to the degree that the state requires my property, to the degree that my neighbor requires some of my property, he's going to pay me, if I sell it to him, he's going to pay me not only for what he buys from me, but also for the damage that results to me.
Well, he may or may not.
He can decide not to buy it if he wishes to. But
he may choose to buy you out, in which case the price might be much more.
And the state has the option in both those cases. The state can buy the tack in its entirety, or the state, if the bill is too high, can redesign its road, as the state has done. And the state has those same things. The basic principles, if you go all the way back, is to make the landowner whole. So the Constitution defines whole as adequate compensation. Adequate compensation has been defined by this court and hundreds of other courts in Texas as being market value. Market value has been defined by this court, and in fact, the definition of market value submitted by the state to the judge to instruct the jury. And the question for the jury is, what's the decrease in market value of the property? The instruction given by the state was based on willing buyers and sellers. What factors would willing buyers and sellers take into account? Now, the argument that Mr. Johnson also made was that in this case we're trying to get paid for something other than property rights, and that's not the case. We are entitled to damages, the decrease in market value of the remaining property. What gives property its value are often incidental attributes. Its visibility, its location, its proximity to other employers. That's what gives any piece of property its value.
But those are not property rights.
Those are absolutely not property rights. But this court has held that, for example, when you put a pipeline, a gas pipeline, through someone's property, he's entitled to remainder property damages due to fear in the marketplace of having a pipeline close to your property. Now, that fear does not physically affect your use of the property. That fear is not a property right. But in fact, it is something that affects willing buyers and sellers. That same property owner, and that case would be the Hedden case, which is cited in the briefs, but that same property owner, Justice Heck, who has that pipeline going in his neighbor's yard, in the adjacent property, who has the same kinds of damages, is not entitled to compensation because he can't prove the requisite liability to ever get to the damage stage. And in fact, construction activity has been treated the same way under the law with respect to the Spindor case and the Avenue case. The Avenue case stands for the proposition that not every damaging results in accrual of liability. You have to first show liability, a substantial material interference. But the statute...
Isn't it fair to say that it's hard to draw a straight line through these cases?
I think the line that we've drawn is the only straight line that you can draw. To the degree that the court starts picking out factors which are not compensable under the market value test, I don't know how you would try one of these cases. Do we pretend that the property did not have good visibility in the before situation, even though those are all the comps everyone's using? Or do we pretend that it had good visibility in the after situation when we're finding comparables of property that are affecting? I don't know how one, the straightest line, I think, the truest line for this court to draw is one that applies the market value test.
The argument is that even if this position can be justified by prior holdings of this court, constitution, and statutes, it is an extension of those positions, and it will have a marked effect on condemnation in this state. What's your response to that?
I don't think that it's an extension at all. I don't think that there is one case that needs to be overruled. I mean, I don't think this is how we've been trying cases, and I know that I've only been trying condemnation cases for 10 years, but this is how we have always tried cases.
So there's nothing new here.
There is nothing new here as far it's a going back to the basic willing buyer and willing seller test. That's all that this is.
Have any of these old cases that you've been trying for 10 years had appellate opinions?
No, sir.
Well, picking up on the last part of Justice X's question, I gather that the drift that I get from some of the briefs that have been filed against you in this case is that I might as well sell my car because no highways are going to be constructed after you prevail in this case. Could you respond more particularly to the impact that a holding on behalf of your clients and the law it would establish would have?
Yes, sir. These projects are going to cost a certain amount of money. When you widen a road through an urban area, it's going to cost. This case is not about decreasing that cost. This case is purely about apportioning that cost. And the question is, when the community benefits by putting in this kind of project, shouldn't the community pay that cost as opposed to giving a disproportionate share of that cost to a few property owners?
But the question though is, if it costs $183 a square foot to build a highway, to get the land to build a highway,
yes,
how many are going to be built? Is it the same number or fewer? The argument in the briefs is, oh, this will have a tremendous impact on highways.
No decision if this roadway is going to cost $183 a square foot. If that's the real cost, no decision by this court is going to decrease that cost. It's purely a question of who pays that cost. In fact, quite the opposite is true. And by the way, since this is a policy consideration, I'm going to leave the record for just a moment. In my case, when I tried my case, when the state began these constructions, and the evidence in the Schmidt case, are 30 and 40 foot piles of dirt in front of commercial establishments. Those piles of dirt completely block any visibility any of these commercial establishments might have had during construction. By the time Mr. McClish tried his case a month and a half later, and recognizing that the state was going to be held responsible for its own design and its own efficiencies and its own plans, now there's a new requirement that now all the contractors that work out there never let piles get above 5 feet high, and at the end of every day they cart away the dirt. In a very real sense, only so long as you make the person who is responsible for the plans and the ability to control costs, insofar you only have a chance to decrease costs if you make that person responsible for those costs. To the degree that they can put those costs on adjoining property owners and not be held responsible for those costs, then you have no control over those costs. The condemnation of the Arboretum Shopping Center, 183, is a good example. They're taking the driveway of the Arboretum Shopping Center, going to be doing construction there for two Christmas seasons, causing loss of a lot of tenants. Tenants have kick-out clauses. It's going to cause real impact on the market value of property.
But the question, though, is, assuming that only so much can be shared by the populace, assuming that the populace is willing to share only so much, will this... Are we anywhere near a constraint? Is $500,000 an acre more than you can pay to buy land to build a highway?
We've seen in the cases that we've been trying, there have been new appraisals. In fact, the appraisals now are being done consistent with the lower appellate Schmidt case. And in a lot of cases, we see no or virtually no increases, and in some cases, we see larger increases. In some situations like the Arboretum, the state, recognizing that they get a very large special commissioner's award, go back and redesign the road and don't take any property from the Arboretum at all. So that stretch of the road now costs less, but it only costs less because they were being held responsible for the cost that they incur. The last issue in this case that's presented for the court is the one of community damages. Community damages, I don't think, is really an exception to the market value test at all, but rather is consistent with it. The theory behind community damages is that you're only going to make landowners whole, you're not going to make them more than whole. And to the degree that the whole community suffers the same damage, to compensate one property owner for that damage is to put him in better than a whole situation. The community damage issue before this court is very simple. In evidence at trial was evidence of the effect of this project on sales on Anderson Lane. Here's 183, and here's the subject property. There was absolutely no evidence that any property other than those abutting 183 suffered any damage associated with this project. In fact, other properties in the neighborhood were holding their own or increasing in value. The sole question for this court is whether or not community damages can be shown only with reference to properties that abut the highway. There was absolutely no evidence of a piece of property a half block off the road that suffered the kind of damages that we're talking about in this case. I would conclude and pass the baton to Mr. McClish by suggesting and pointing out to the court that when the government is up here on a paving lien case, or trying to prove tax value, the government says that the property's been enhanced by each of these factors when it does it. And in a paving lien case where you're only allowed to charge an assessment equal to how much a property is increased in value, the government is taking the exact opposite position. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
If it pleases the court, counsel, as y'all can't tell, there's not much condemnation law being practiced in Austin this morning. I want to take just a few minutes to address the policy implications of the exceptions that the government is arguing here to the market value test. And before doing that, I want to remind the court that the market value test is established not just in at least a dozen opinions of this court, but by the legislature in the statute that allows the government to take somebody's land. And the only exceptions that are authorized by the statute, 21.042 of the property code, are those which are properly characterized as community damages.
If this is nothing new, that statute has always had this result, then why is this case in such a moment, such a apparent moment?
Yes, sir. And why has the government taken such care to choose two cases to come forward where the facts at least appear to be so much in their favor? I am presuming that it goes back to the argument, the cost argument, that the court has already asked Mr. Adler about it and that he's already spoken about, and I'm presuming that it's a good faith argument by the government for their belief that these costs that occur to landowners along the road ought to be left by them, left with them, rather than being shouldered by all the members of the community alike. I do want to argue that ought not to be the standard, and I think in assessing these cases, you do need to remember these are the test cases that the government's chosen to bring up here. These are the best ones for them. The measure of damages under the statute and the measure of damages announced by this court most recently in Callejo is the difference between the fair market value of the whole property without reference to the condemnation and the market value of the remainder, considering the effect of the condemnation upon the market value of the remainder. That's what the statute says, what the legislature has said, and that's what this court says is the proper charge. The Constitution mandates adequate compensation. And what that means is, in a condemnation case like this, where liability is admitted by the government, this is not an inverse case where we have to prove liability. They come in and admit our title and admit they're taking our land. What that means is the court should try to put the landowner back in the place financially, monetarily, where he was when we found him. We should give him enough money in his condemnation award that he can sell his remainder and be made whole, have the amount of money that represented the fair market value of the whole before he started. And these exceptions to the rule that the government is asking you to make, in cases like this, and in every case where they choose to build a freeway through an urban area that's been commercially developed, those exceptions are going to be in serious derogation of the market value test and of making the landowner whole.
Why isn't just as consistent or more consistent with the scheme of condemnation law to pay the landowner for the property actually taken and leave him and his neighbor both, whose property is not taken, to proving some inverse condemnation claim if they can?
Well, in the first place, it's because that the legislature has said that that's not the way that damages are supposed to be enacted. And this court has recognized that the legislature's duty is to set that measure of damages. But in the second place, it represents to me at least such a divergence from the market value test from somebody who has tried condemnation cases, unfortunately, for more than 10 years. It represents such a divergence from the market value test as to make these cases very difficult indeed to administer. Seven maids and seven mops and seven courts of appeals won't be able to decide all the cases trying to define the parameters of this exception to a statutory market value test any better than the courts have been able to wrestle and grasp with the standard of liability in inverse cases dealing with access. If there is a Serbonian bog in Texas law, it is what constitutes a material and substantial impairment of access in an inverse condemnation case. And the trial judge in the Schmidt in the Austex case, for example, Justice Niles, conducted a hearing under Wood Oil, and the evidence lasted for an hour and a half before he decided that the landowners in this case, if they needed to prove the material and substantial impairment of access, were going to be able to do that. As a matter of fact, in the Schmidt case, they didn't even ask for a hearing on that issue. To the extent that interjecting these issues into the trial of a condemnation case is going to segment the case and make it more difficult, and is going to make for appellate litigation, I suggest to you that from a policy perspective, these exceptions, which I don't believe to be warranted by the statute, would certainly be unwise from a standpoint of judicial economy. And finally, I do ask the court to remember something that Mr. Adler, I think, stated very well, and I don't think Mr. Johnson will deny. The costs are there. The damages that the landowners are suffering are there and they're real, and it's part of the government's argument that they're so big they ought not be spread over the 100 million taxpayers out there who are going to enjoy the use of the road. They ought to be left with the 500 owners that were unlucky enough to be in the way of progress. I read the constitutional scheme and the statutory scheme to say that is one argument that the government may not make and that this court may not buy.
Any questions? Thank you.
Your Honor, the question that is asked throughout the state in determining damages to the remainder to the jury is, what is the decrease, if any, in the market value of the remainder parcel, one, caused by the taking of the part taken, and two, considering the uses to which the part taken will or may be put? When cases are affirmed as appropriate damaging, it relates to damages caused from one of those two elements, either damages caused by the loss of the part taken, parking spaces were lost, a building was lost, driveways had to be relocated, that buildings had to be reconstructed or cured with some new wall put on the front. Those kinds of damages are certainly compensable. And the other area is considering the uses to which the part taken will be put. Now, that's just the part taken. That's not the entire project. And State versus Clark, this court has said exactly that. The pipeline fear is within that category. The part taken was used for a pipeline, and considering the uses to which the part taken would be put had an effect on the value of the remainder.
Well, but they say here the part taken is going to be used for a highway that's too high for anybody to see the property.
No, sir. The part taken is a 6.5-foot strip that will remain just that and will be frontage road just as the other property is frontage road. It's well, the 6.5-foot strip is the all the same.
But you mean if the highway was on the 6-foot strip as opposed to the frontage road, it would be a different case?
If the construction were going on the part taken, then the cases like State versus Clark said that should be considered. That was almost an identical situation. Causeway was being constructed and the highway was being elevated. The court said that the landowner had a property right in a parkway, a park that was out in front of his motel. And because he had a property right, he could receive compensation. But then they say, and upon retrial of this case, the trial court is to consider only the on-ramp that is used in the park, across the park, and the rest of the highway, the elevated construction, should not be considered. It should be presumed that it was already there so that it did not receive compensation. It is the compensation for the use to which the park taken will be put. That's why the City of Pearland versus City of Pearland versus Alexander. It was the reasonable probable uses to the actual area that was to be taken.
It seems to blink reality to say just because they build a curb on this 6 feet, but that doesn't mean there's a 40-foot highway right next to it.
That's a factor. That is a factor that the courts for 100 years have said that will have an effect, but that is a consequential damaging. That is a fact that the legislature has said may have an effect, but in 21.042D says you don't consider those things that are community damages, and the courts have traditionally said community damages are those things that may be damaged to the value of the property, but they're things that nobody owns. Things like a volume of traffic and visual prominence.
What is your response to the argument made here this morning and also in the briefs that if this were a private circumstance and your neighbor needed a square foot to build, for example, guy wire for his own use on his own property, you would charge him also for the damage that his use was causing your property?
My response is the law says market value, not hostage value. If the neighbor built their structure and then said, and I want to buy now that my structure's built, now that I have a right to do independently, now I want to buy the strip, The seller may want to hold them hostage, and that's true, but the statute says we pay market value and not hostage value. The fairness issue is one that has always been limited. All constitutional provisions, the condemnation provision included, has limits.
Let me be sure I understand you correctly. The use to which the property is going to be put doesn't affect the market value, you're saying?
Yes, the use to which the park taken.
You're saying if he builds his tower and then wants to buy a strip, the market value of the strip at that time. But if he wants to buy the strip to build the tower and needs it to build the tower, that doesn't affect the market value.
That is what the court has said in State versus Clark.
The use to which it's to be put does not affect its market value. That's basically what you're saying.
Well, that's
that we ignore the use that's being acquired for.
I would say that State versus Clark says that
doesn't that eliminate market bargaining? I mean, I don't understand. It seems to eliminate market factors.
It does eliminate some factors, but that's, we're going to have to say that State versus Clark was just wrong when they said don't consider just the ramp, but consider also what's going to be built as the elevated freeway on the highway department's existing properties.
May have been.
All constitutional provisions have limits. There's a fairness to the city and the state, as well as the fairness to the landowner. And the fairness to the city and the state is that we be treated the same as a private neighbor.
If this landowner whose property is being taken should be relegated to an inverse condemnation action, could he prevail?
not without overruling at least state Supreme Court cases. These are things that nobody owns. As early as Fort Worth Improvement District in 1913, the court has said that's what makes it a community-type damage. Wood Oil Distributing is a case that recognizes that same thing. And incidentally, this idea that, well, Wood Oil Distributing wasn't really a direct condemnation case. They were asking for business damages or something other than damage to property. The Court of Appeals opinion, as Courts of Appeals opinions usually do, go into more detail on the facts. And it says, appellant's contention that the proposed changes would result in a material and substantial impairment of access to the truck stop and would result to a diminished value to the remainder of the land. The Wood Oil Distributing is about a claim for damage to the remainder of the value of the land, not some pendant inverse claim for business losses. Let me finish by saying that there is a principle here of legislative action as opposed to unilaterally making this expanse that respondents would have you make. This court many years ago, in considering a claim for relocation expenses reimbursement, said no, that was not a part of condemnation. It is an effect on the landowner whose entire property is taken or so very severely damaged that they can't remain. There's nothing left. Those people have an expense of relocation. The court said, no, that was not part of condemnation. The remedy was for the legislature to come forward and say, that's something we wish to pay for. And so a separate statute was passed for fairness to the landowner to add compensation for reimbursement of those relocation expenses. The legislature concerning community damages, things that nobody owns that may be affected, has said just the opposite. In 21.042D, they said you don't get paid for that. Now, if that's not fair, then that's something that the legislature should repeal, not the Austin Court of Appeals. And if it's appropriate for the legislature to step in and say, we will instruct or put limits on the way, the techniques of construction that can be used, because we find that that would be helpful to the public, the legislature can and should do that. Let me mention one last statute, because the Court of Appeals mentions it in the Monday Enterprises case. The court cites Article 1085A, saying that, well, here's a statute that says when a highway is upgraded to a freeway, you get paid for loss of access. Well, with all deference, Section 3 of that same statute specifically says freeway means when you've cut off legal access. You're making a highway into a freeway without frontage roads, like parts of MOPAC are, not this situation here where frontage roads and legal access remains to its fullest.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument, and all the causes, the foregoing causes, are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court detective now stands adjourned, subject to call.